Welcome to The Vampire Squid, a podcast about increasing transparency and education in finance. This is your host, Alan Lee, and welcome to episode 44 of The Vampire Squid. Today we have on a very special guest, Scott Tindall from Finimize, which provides a daily financial newsletter, which is super easy to digest and something that I've been using for the last few months and have really enjoyed it. And before we jump into the highlights of the episode, I just wanted to reach out to see if any of my listeners have experience with mobile graphic design or who have friends that work with mobile graphic design. If so, please reach out to me at Alan, A-L-A-N, at thevampiresquid.com, and it would be ideal if they are in New York. After that aside, today's episode I think is really intriguing because the mission of Finimize is very similar to that of the Vampire Squid, to provide transparency in finance, because it's really easy to get lost and confused in what these articles written by the Wall Street Journal or other sources of financial literature, what they really mean. And Finimize breaks it down and makes it very easy to digest. And it also has a very important part where it says, why is this important to you? And I thought that since I've been using the resource for quite a while and I've actually known the co-founder, I thought it'd be great to bring Scott on to talk about his experience starting the company and what the goals and missions are of Finimize. So without further ado, please welcome Scott Tindall, and I hope that you guys enjoy. So welcome to the Vampire Squid. I have on very special guest with me today, Scott Tindall from Finimize. Scott, thanks so much for coming on to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Great. Scott, would you mind giving a quick background of how you got to Finimize and maybe where you went to school, your first few jobs, and what inspired you?
Definitely, for sure. So I'm originally from Vancouver, Canada, but I came over to the UK when I was 18 to go to university at the University of St. Andrews. I graduated from there in 2007. And was doing the sort of hiring rounds for the investment banks in the fall of 2006, which was obviously one of the biggest bull markets ever, and wasn't too difficult to get a job, which they thankfully hired an art student at that stage to sell. I got hired by Barclays to sell mortgage-backed securities.
Starting studying art.
It was an arts degree, so it was basically poli-sci. Which is, you can still get into Wall Street with that sort of degree, but it's a little bit harder than it was, say, in 2006, certainly. I got hired to sell mortgage-backed securities in the summer of 07, which, if you've seen The Big Short, I would have basically been Jared's junior at a time when it was just starting to implode. So I started, but very quickly the bank and everybody else realized they didn't need too many new mortgage-backed security salespeople. So I was moved very quickly to convertible bonds, which is a bit of a niche area, but it sort of sits between equity and credit in most banks. Some different banks have it report to different areas. And I started off as a convertible bond salesperson, which is what I did for 7 years. At Barclays until 2014, and until I decided basically it was time to do something a little bit more entrepreneurial. And I left, shortly after leaving, a friend of mine from university, who had immediately gone into the startup route, wanted to do basically a personal finance based startup, called Finimize, and he needed some writers. So initially I sort of started writing for him as it was a kind of an idea, to testing the idea out, basically. And one thing led to another, and we decided to co-found the company a few months later, basically.
Very cool. And was Barclays, was that in New York, or was that in
That was in London. Yeah, that was all in London.
Got it. How did the mortgage-backed securities market differ in London than in the U.S.? Because we usually think of it as, the housing crisis, or at least from my perspective, in the United States. But was it different? Was it similar in Europe?
Well, the housing crisis was very different. But a lot of the structuring of the securities and a lot of the sales of the securities were distributed out of London. Not because it wasn't just American investors buying the packaged mortgages, basically. Obviously, it was all through the world.
Yep.
But the crisis really was, obviously the whole world got affected by the financial crisis, but the mortgage crisis was particularly the subprime mortgage, the really, not unaffordable housing, but the cheaper housing that was unaffordable for the people that were buying it at the time, was a very American problem, basically, mm-hmm. which had a lot of international investors involved with, with it. I had a front row seat to the financial implications of it, but I'd say Americans, got a front row seat to the real life implications of it, basically, seeing people losing their homes and that sort of thing.
Got it. And you said you were at St. Andrews. Have you been to the Open Championship?
Yes. Yes. I was there in 2015, I think it was, last time I was there. In fact, I think I've been there every time since I was a student at St. Andrews.
That's awesome.
It's a special place. The town is special, whether you're a golfer or not. Some people don't realize it was the seat of the Church of Scotland for hundreds and hundreds of years. So there's a lot of history to the town. It's a lot of Scottish history to the town itself. Never mind, you bring the golf in, and the golf is obviously a big part of it now.
Yep. Yep. Okay. So you were trading at Barclays for 7 years. What was the impetus for doing something entrepreneurial?
For me, I hugely enjoyed my time at Barclays. I hugely enjoyed my job. Being a bond salesperson is particularly coming straight out of university is a lot of fun. You get to deal with some of the world's smartest and savviest investors. The people you work with are really, really top class, and you learn a lot very, very quickly. I think as I spent sort of 5 or 6 or 7 years there, I was basically ready for a change. And at the time, it's less true now, but at the time, European banks in general, there was a lot more, there was some more restriction, basically. It wasn't getting more interesting, probably, if that's fair. I think that's fair to say. I think that's changing to some extent now, actually. But I was basically ready for a new challenge. And convertible bonds is a fantastic product area. And historically, some people have gone from that product area to found some of the world's largest hedge funds and run some of the world's biggest banks. But I guess I probably felt it was a long ways in the future, and I was ready to do something where I had maybe a little bit more skin in the game in terms of having an equity interest in my own company, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And talk a little bit more about the decision process too, because I'm sure, after 7 years at Barclays, it must be a fairly comfortable lifestyle, and giving that all up for the startup venture, there must have been a lot of decision making in that aspect.
Definitely. And it's a very interesting question. If you're somebody who knows you want to go down the entrepreneurial route in your life, what should you do? I mean, there's no one path, obviously. My co-founder went essentially straight into a startup that he co-founded and did very well with. And I think to some extent, if you're a true entrepreneur, a true believer in that way of, you have that sort of ability to have that sort of vision and belief, you might never go work for a big firm because you just know what you want to do. The other sort of angle is go work for a big firm for at least a couple of years and get sort of that thing on your CV and get the big bank experience or whatever it is. But then, people plan to leave after 18 months or 2 years and then go do their own thing pretty quickly. I don't think that many people do what I did for 7 years and then pick up sticks and move on. Arguably, it was maybe too long to be ideal. The other side of it is, it took me a while to get my CFA, to get the experience I wanted. In my case, I wanted to become a UK citizen because I had some, work permit was tied to my work basically for most of that time period. So there was some angle there. But certainly the longer you stay in a job, the easier the job gets. Doesn't necessarily get easy, but you get better at it. And it becomes, more enjoyable in the sense that you're not sort of constantly pulling out your hair, wondering if you're messing things up. And obviously your compensation goes up typically, particularly in the first, initial years. So it's tougher to leave a job where you're getting paid more and it's easier than one where you're getting paid less and it's harder. I guess, I don't know if your question was about advice, but to some degree, the sooner you get out, the more you're going to actually test yourself in an entrepreneurial way. At the same time, for me, it got to the point basically where I thought it was now or never. And I think that's right. 7 years is a long time to be somewhere if you're planning on doing something yourself. You're going to get to that point sooner than later. And 7 is probably about the top of that range, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it seems to have worked out for this scenario because the pros and cons are, you were there a little bit longer, but since the startup is financially focused, you have more expertise in the area and, you started as a content writer and eventually you helped co-found the company. So at least this seems to have benefited you in quite a few ways.
Yes, that's 100%. I mean, if I was going to leave and go try to start the next Tinder or something, I probably wouldn't have needed 7 years.
Do you guys use Tinder in London?
I mean, I don't. My girlfriend would probably get a little annoyed, but but yeah, I don't know if it's less popular now. Certainly, when it came out 2 or 3 years ago, it was very, very popular.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about Finimize. And I've been a subscriber since, we spoke quite a few months ago, and I think the content's awesome. So give us a quick background on what Finimize is and what the goal is so that our listeners have an idea of what you guys are trying to accomplish.
Definitely. I mean, at the very base of everything we're trying to do is to make finance more accessible to people. And the Finimize format was very much my co-founder's vision, which was let's start with financial news. He actually tried to pick up one of the major financial press papers. He sort of made a New Year's resolution a few years ago to read it routinely and to understand what was going on in finance, and found it just in tech words, incredibly user unfriendly. Long articles, most articles on the front page of the big publications are 1,000 words long, full of jargon that you probably only understand if you work in the industry. And that's on purpose, of course. It's targeted at these people that go onto Wall Street. It's meant to be writing for them. And he basically said there's no writing for the normal people in the world who do want to know what's going on with this stuff. And also, probably crucially, most crucially, why it's important to their lives. And so he came up with this concept of summarizing and explaining the news and making it relevant. From day one, I thought that's a brilliant idea. I truly don't think there's very many, in fact, there's very, very few companies trying to do what we're doing, which is to take financial news and democratize it, basically.
Yeah, I noticed that the layout goes usually the summary, and then it has a nice addition where it says, why does this matter to you? Which seems like it touches upon the point of your founder's mission to see why this financial news even matters to everyday people.
Exactly. And that is, I think, really the differentiator for us. It's also, to some extent for us, the protection in the business model, at least from the email standpoint, because it's not that easy to take, any given example. Inflation's actually the easiest. Inflation seems to be going up recently, so we can tie that pretty directly to telling people about the impact on their wallet and that sort of thing. The umming and awing over the Fed interest rate hike, how do you make that relevant to people, basically? How do you interpret this news? And I think that's where people find the real value in the email. And also from a business standpoint, it's not that difficult, but it's also not that easy. So you need some expertise and some experience to be able to do that, basically.
Yeah. And how do you guys source your content? And I'm always curious about these newsletters, and I subscribe to a few other ones, but I'm very curious how you guys get your content. Do you guys just source through the Wall Street Journal or New York Times or these other publications for content, or is there something proprietary? How do you guys do it?
So it's totally manual. I think certainly, having worked on a trading floor for my previous career, there's always those three or four or five stories that drive the news flow that day, whether it's a Fed meeting or Janet Yellen giving a speech or certain companies publishing their results. It's pretty clear whether you look at the various financial media sources, or whether sometimes I'll see what sort of brokers are sending around in their morning reports, morning emails to clients. It's pretty clear there's sort of three or four stories that are at least driving the narrative. I always hesitate to say they're actually driving the prices in the market, but they're certainly driving the narrative of the day. And given where, you know, we're basically writing markets news, there's always sort of two to six stories to choose from, basically. So that makes it easier. The other thing, and I think this is very important, is that we sort of have a number of themes in our head that we see going on and we want to cover. So rising inflation is a good one. You know, if you look back in our writing, we started writing about that as it was happening in sort of September, October time. And if there was like a change in narrative there, inflation stopped going down, it started going up. So we started writing about it. And then you might cover rising inflation on a Tuesday. Well, you're not going to cover it again on a Thursday. You're going to wait 10 days and maybe give people an update or until the story has changed. So the idea is that if people are paying attention to us on a daily basis, we don't necessarily have to write a story with the same takeaways 10 days later if nothing has changed. So we sort of have a dozen themes in our mind that we kind of want to cover. And then company reports play a big role in it as well, because obviously some of the tech-facing names, if you're a user of these companies, you like reading about them as well. And because they're now the world's biggest companies, it makes a lot of sense to report on them as well. So there's no science to it, basically. But it's through that manual curation process. If you're a regular reader, you're going to get a pretty broad understanding of what's going on in finance, basically.
Yeah, and I'm curious, since you guys are based in London, do people in different countries have different finimis? And I know that obviously the markets and the factors are very global today, and what happens in one area affects others. But you know, there probably is some skews towards country-specific financial news as well. So do people have different finimis based on their location?
We do. We have three editions, our global, which is what most people subscribe to, our European and our UK European and our American. And what we say for the other regions is that there will be at least one story that is directly relevant to that region. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't mean that you're only going to read European news, but you're going to get one that at least is about your area. But it's actually been interesting to note that initially, when we opened this up, we had basically the vast majority still continue to subscribe to the global. And that might be a reflection of our readers. It's sort of the type of readers, a younger version of the type of readers that would read The Economist. So you might be sitting in New York, but you're actually kind of interested to know that Chinese investors have just bought one of London's biggest skyscrapers. And we try to make the takeaways relevant to kind of globally aware people. Sometimes if we write, say, a piece on UK property prices, we'll probably only put that in the UK edition because we realize that, you know, not too many Americans really care. But so there's some choice. But actually, I think it's good to have that choice. But if you could go back, you could make a pretty good argument that there's no need for regional editions just based on what people are signing up for.
Got it. How do you guys make money?
Very good question. With a very easy answer, which is that we don't, pretty much.
classic startup. I love it.
Exactly. I mean, there are ways we could make money tomorrow. We could put advertising in the email. We could create a premium product where, say, we write five stories a day and X percent of our users might pay $5 a month for access to all of them. Mm-hmm. But we're building this platform called Finimize My Life, which is really where this company is going, which is digital personal financial guidance. So you think you can go onto your computer, you can fill in a few questions and devise your own financial plan, basically, or at least guidance towards that plan in the early stages. And so that's the longer term game plan, so to speak, is to continue this idea of making finance more accessible to everybody and broadening that, not definition, but broadening that kind of strategy out to beyond financial news to personal financial services. And that's really where we're going.
Uh-huh. And Thinamize My Life becomes an acronym FML, which I love. So I actually looked a little bit into that product, and it seems like you guys are giving it away for free for now. So tell us a little bit about what the longer-term plan is for that. So am I to sign up for FML to get help with personal financial management, like credit cards and loans, or is that more for investing, like what stocks should I buy or what areas should I get into?
It's much more about financial planning. And, you know, people compare it. People say to me, oh, so you're building a robo-advisor. Don't they have a lot of those? And if you're familiar with that market, the easiest comparison is to say, well, a robo-advisor might suggest 60% stock, 40% bonds, and sort of a mix appropriate to the questionnaire you've answered. Yeah. We're not so concerned with that as much as we're going to be more concerned with, I want to buy a house in 7 years. How much do I need to save for that to buy a house in this part of the country? You know, assuming I'm going to get a few raises over the next few years. And what should I do with the savings I'm accumulating while I'm saving for that house? If that makes sense, it's much more coming at it from a financial planning standpoint than a stocks and bonds sort of thing. Obviously, investments are a part of that, but so are things like creating an emergency fund, you know, having 3 months of your salary, at least 3 months of your salary in kind of ultra safe cash in case you lose your job, or having some income protection in case, you know, something, in case you have an accident and you're not able to work at the same type of job you thought you were. So it's more holistic, basically.
Yeah, and it seems like with that product, you actually speak with a real person too. Is that correct?
Well, not in the way that we're doing it, basically. So we're trying to make this entirely digital, which is certainly the challenge. But also, you know, where this space will go that direction. It's just a matter of how quickly, I think. To some degree, there's both a pull factor, which is that, you know, obviously people are becoming much more comfortable interacting digitally with a vast array of things that people might have never thought they would do digitally. But also companies, you know, if people don't have a lot of money today to invest, companies are going to want to use digital products to service them because it's less expensive to do so. On the regulatory standpoint, there's much more, particularly outside the U.S., but there's some things in the U.S. that might change in this regard as well. It's becoming much less common to have an advisor essentially sell financial products to people and kind of take a commission or like a high fee for that on an ongoing basis. So I think there's going to be a real demand from providers of advice or guidance and consumers to do as much as they can digitally, basically.
I recently signed up for Credit Karma, which I think you probably know, which is the credit card, and it provides your credit score and it gives you some advice into which credit cards you can buy or you can apply for to help build your credit. So I definitely see a lot of demand in this sort of fintech personal financial management area. So it's cool that you guys are in this space and trying to transform it a little bit with both the newsletter and this FML product.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's hugely relevant. You know, our readers are, the vast majority of our readers are 18 to 35. And that demographic obviously is beginning to have a job, beginning to and maybe have a little bit of extra income in the sense of what they should do, you know, asking what they should do with it. And also, as that demographic gets older, clearly things get a little bit more real. You start thinking about getting married, buying a house, having kids. And that's where money becomes much more important in a way. You know, your brain power starts, most people's brain power then kicks in and they start thinking about how they can maximize their money because they now have other people to think about, basically.
So thank you guys for listening to part one of the interview with Scott Tindall. And as a reminder, if you work in mobile graphic design or know a friend that has experience with mobile graphic design that is preferably in New York, do please let me know at alan@thevampiresquid.com. And please stay tuned for next week's episode, which is part two of this week's interview with Scott Tindall, where we dive a little bit deeper into Scott's thoughts on things that people in finance don't realize about the financial industry, or some of the things that they should learn to come up the curve a little bit quicker. So thanks again for listening, and I'll talk to you guys next week. Ciao.